Watson said is that even now they don't admit they... From WBUR Boston and PRI, I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. The Microsoft judge Penfield Jackson cut the electronic monster in two yesterday and twisted the knife a little. The problem with Bill Gates and Microsoft, Judge Jackson said, is that even now they don't admit they've bullied the competition and stifled the software explosion. They're just the sort of tyrant you can't have stalking this marketplace. Bill Gates, the richest man in the world, the Babe Ruth of the computer era so far, will go to the Supreme Court with the argument that he did well by doing good for all of us. He knows that for all the monster talk, he's a popular hero too. The people, he believes, would rather break up the government. He'll insist to the end that you can't have the government writing the business plans of a dynamic new economy, but it's the dynamism in that economy that he's got to worry about, all those other eager players who want to be Bill Gates's too, on an open playing field. The Microsoft case is next on The Connection. First, this news.
BBC News with Mary Small. The British Foreign Secretary, Robin Cook, has personally assured the President of Sierra Leone, Ahmed Tidjane Kabba, that Britain will maintain a military presence after the withdrawal of most of its forces next week. Last month, Britain sent a naval task force and more than 1,000 troops to Sierra Leone to support government and United Nations forces against rebels who control much of the interior. This report by Mark Doyle in Freetown.
Mr. Cook told President Kabba that Britain's commitment to Sierra Leone remained a long-term one. He stressed that some British forces would remain here, including a team training the government army and two warships. The people of Freetown will see those ships every morning, Mr. Cook said, implying that this would be a reassuring presence. President Kabba said he had agreed with Britain on the way forward and underlined that the United Nations forces here were now reinforcing in such a way that they should be effective.
The British defense attaché in Greece has been shot and killed in an ambush in the capital, Athens. The army officer, Brigadier Stephen Saunders, was attacked by two men on a motorcycle as he drove to work. He was shot several times and later died in hospital. The gunmen escaped. Paul Wood reports from Athens.
Brigadier Saunders was driving to work through the busy Athens traffic when two assailants on a motorcycle drew alongside his car and repeatedly fired shots through the passenger window. Witnesses say the brigadier staggered from his vehicle and collapsed on the pavement. He died in hospital from multiple gunshot wounds later. The weapon used was apparently a 45 caliber handgun, one of the trademarks of the notorious far-left group November 17, which has a 25-year record of attacks against Western diplomats here. Not one member of November 17 has ever been caught and jailed by the Greek police. With international concerns high about security for the 2004 Olympic Games, the Greek authorities are promising that the killers of Brigadier Saunders will not escape justice.
As Russian forces continue to come under attack in Chechnya, President Putin has signed a decree setting up a provisional administration there. The new body, which must also be approved by the Russian parliament, would replace the current Russian government representative in Chechnya. Reports from Moscow suggest President Putin will establish direct presidential rule over the new administration, with elections coming later. In the latest violence, the Kremlin has confirmed that Chechen rebels carried out their first suicide bombing against Russian forces yesterday, killing two soldiers. Serb inhabitants in the Yugoslav province of Kosovo say they'll continue a series of protests over the killing last week of eight Serbs until the international community takes serious steps to protect their community. The statement was made as the province marks the first anniversary of the entry into Kosovo of the NATO-led peacekeeping force. Speaking in the Greek city of Thessaloniki yesterday, the European Security Advisor, Javier Solana, said the treatment of Serbs in Kosovo was intolerable. The BBC correspondent in Yugoslavia says that despite the presence of the international peacekeeping force, the divide between the local Albanians and the dwindling Serb community is as sharp as ever. You're listening to the news from the BBC. A ship of the Australian Navy is helping an evacuation program to rescue foreign nationals from the conflict in the Solomon Islands. It's anchored off the capital, Honiara. The first civilians to be taken aboard were women and children. A warship from New Zealand is also on its way and is expected to arrive on Saturday. The Australian Foreign Minister, John Moore, says that so far the evacuation is going as planned.
Now, currently the Tobruk is alongside in Honiara. They're taking aboard as many refugees as want to leave Honiara. Currently some hundreds are on board, we don't know the precise numbers. There's currently about 700 Australians, about 600 other nationalities. The ship can take of the order of 800, and if the ship fills tonight, we'll move out and presumably come to Australia, and we'll review the matter tomorrow morning as to how the rest of the evacuation takes place.
The Eritrean government has started moves to expel thousands of Ethiopians from its capital, Asmara, and send them back to Ethiopia. The Eritrean authorities have said that all Ethiopians must register for repatriation as soon as possible, but the program is said to be voluntary, and only people wishing to go will be included. The two countries have been at war for the past 2 years, and at the beginning of the conflict, Ethiopia expelled 70,000 Eritreans. There are an estimated 40,000 Ethiopians in Asmara, many of whom have lived there all their lives. BBC News.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. The world's richest man, the great oligarch of the new economy, Bill Gates, is a defiant guy today. He won't accept Federal Judge Thomas Penfield Jackson's ruling to break up Microsoft into separate and competing apps and ops companies. He rejects this whole model of the Standard Oil breakup in 1911 and the AT&T breakup of 1984. Bill Gates' defiant attitude, though, is part of the problem, Judge Jackson said. Microsoft, he wrote, as it is presently organized and led, is unwilling to accept the notion that it broke the law. The old monopoly models, from oil refineries to phone lines, may sound obsolete, but the American antitrust idea still applies in the internet age, Judge Jackson said. For lots of new companies, the ruling and the lawsuit, which has been going on for 2.5 years now, mean new life in an industry that's been dominated by Microsoft for so long. They're looking through a new window into the post-PC, post-Microsoft world. We're looking through that window with them this hour. We're talking about the Microsoft breakup. Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. The 1-800-423-TALK. Are you celebrating the Microsoft News Connection, listeners? What's it going to mean in the long run? Our guest in the studio, Jonathan Zittrain, is Harvard's philosopher king of internet law and entrepreneurship. We'll be joined by lots of others this hour. But get us started, Jonathan. Is it over? Are we going to have two baby bills, as they say, Microsoft splits?
Strikes me that the legal case is far from over. There'll be plenty of new paperwork to be filed, new judges to hear it, whether at the Court of Appeals level or perhaps directly to the Supreme Court, which Judge Jackson seems to have invited, and I don't see why the Justice Department wouldn't take him up on that. As to whether in the bigger picture, Microsoft's dominance is over, this is definitely a point of inflection for them. Not just the case, but a whole bunch of other factors have put them to the mat again. They have nowhere to go but down, in a sense, because
they've
been so
successful. What's left to argue about in the law here?
In the law, there's a whole set of review now to be done of Judge Jackson's decision, the findings of fact, the conclusions of law, and, of course, his proposed remedy. His proposed remedy is something that came about very quickly. People were very surprised that he didn't have at least a few desultory hearings before coming down on the government's side or on whatever side he was going to. So that now is going to be reviewed at the appellate level for error at varying standards of review.
It seems to me once the government and the judge, and I hate to say it, but once the newspapers and the news keep pounding on this very simple, rather clean and understandable decision, it settles in, maybe to the popular imagination. I can't imagine how this thing could be turned around at this point.
It certainly had been, if not unthinkable, not thought about, the idea of breaking up Microsoft in the public parlance until pretty recently, and probably that was a strategic decision on the part of the government while worrying about the liability phase of the case, not to get into, wow, you really want to break this thing up, huh? This is a goose laying golden eggs. Are you really
Judge
sure
Jackson
you want to...
Judge Jackson says, yeah, you get it. I want to break it up. Get it?
Right, right, exactly.
Ron Cass is on the line. He's the dean of the Boston University Law School, and he knows the antitrust side of this thing well. Is it over, Dean Cass?
I don't think it's nearly over yet, and I think Jonathan's right that we have a lot of time ahead of us in the appeals phase. I doubt at the end of the day that Microsoft will be broken up, because the order that Judge Jackson has entered is vulnerable on many different grounds.
Really? I mean, how does a Supreme Court justice say, no, we're not going to do this? What would the rationale be for turning it around?
Well, first, I don't think it will go directly to the Supreme Court.
It'll get there someday.
Well, it may get there someday. In the meantime, the judge has said that Microsoft violated the law by tying its browser to its operating system. That flies in the face of a decision by the Court of Appeals that will review this. The judge said that Microsoft charged too little for its product. Again, a pricing decision that's vulnerable. Many parts of the judge's underlying decision are subject to attack, and the remedy is an extraordinary remedy.
Yeah. Well, at the same time, we've heard these things. It seems to me, you're not saying it's a cavalier judgment that Microsoft broke the law, or that this kind of explosive, open, intergalactically huge marketplace doesn't need a tyrant that big. I mean, it seems to me the broad lines of it make a kind of sense. I can't imagine it being overturned on findings of law.
Well, I actually think that...
findings of fact is what I meant.
If I were betting on this, I would bet that, in fact, it would be overturned several parts of the judge's decision for him not having used the right standard in the tying part of the case, not having used the right standard in the pricing part of the case. But if you get past that, one of the things you said in the beginning is that Bill Gates is being criticized for rejecting the analogy to Standard Oil and AT&T.
Yep.
This is a very different case. Standard Oil was found to violate the law by gobbling up other companies. And in all of the cases except AT&T where the courts have broken people up, that's been the basis for it. AT&T was a consent decree where they had something to get out of this. They could get out of regulation of one of their lines of business by agreeing to be broken up. That's not the case here. We're getting a breakup combined with very heavy regulation.
Given the findings of fact, let's assume those are not overturned, would you still argue that Microsoft is not too big for this field?
Well, what,
and should not be broken up?
Well, I think the breakup only makes sense if you have the view of the case that the judge and the Justice Department have, that is that this is a giant company that got where it is by misbehaving, not by competing hard, that it sits astride an industry where no one can come in and compete as long as they exist. If you believe all of that, then you want this company broken up, but that's like saying, if there are witches, should we burn them?
Well, they may not
Jonathan Zittrain.
They may not be mutually exclusive things, of course. I mean, I think Microsoft clearly competes very hard. I say that even as a one-time summer intern at Microsoft, which I worked very hard, and the people around me did as well. But it doesn't stop them as well from engaging in certain so-called bad behaviors that the antitrust law can and ought to take notice of and do something about. So if you look at it from the layer of actual doctrine or what ought to happen here, I think Judge Jackson's decision, at least up to the remedy part, is pretty solid in my personal view. If you look at it from the political layer, certainly the Court of Appeals, when this first came up as a consent decree, was so upset with Judge Sporkin's view of the case, who was very much chary of Microsoft, that they not only reversed him, they returned the case to a different judge, which is a highly rare move, which was Judge Jackson. Then when Judge Jackson got the case as a violation of that very consent decree, Again, as the dean points out, he was reversed quite strongly by the Court of Appeals. So as a political matter, you see a Court of Appeals very sympathetic to Microsoft.
I want to introduce Stephen Johnson, who edits feedmag.com. He wrote the book Interface Culture, How New Technology Transforms the Way We Create and Communicate. Steve Johnson, there are a lot of questions here. I want to know, from your general view, has the software business discounted here the bad news for Microsoft? Is the world reshaping itself as if Microsoft were already broken up?
Well, I think that the most useful way to kind of approach that question is to follow the kind of division that was laid down yesterday, which is there are really two worlds here. There's the world of the applications group and the kind of productivity suite software, and then the world of operating systems. And I think the world of operating systems has been pretty competitive, actually, for the last couple of years. In a lot of ways, some of the descriptions of Microsoft's dominance in that field read more like the way things were in 94 and 95, before the web really took off. The place where there's very little competition right now, it seems to me, is when you look at, you know, kind of basic applications like word processors. You really have, if you look, you know, compare, I mean, Gates talks all the time about innovation and protecting, you know, Microsoft's right to innovate and this, you know, great number of products that they've generated and ideas that they've generated. But if you look out there in the larger landscape of the software market, the people who are, you know, compare the people who are working on basic ways to kind of manipulate text on your screen, i.e. Mm-hmm. what a word processor does, compared to, you know, the number of people doing, you know, pet e-commerce websites or devising new ways to do user polls on a website or something like that. There's way more innovation at these tiny little fields on the web, which is basically an open platform, and very little alternatives to Microsoft Word and this most fundamental thing that we do with our computer, which is manipulate text on the screen. So I think, you know, the best news here is that we may see some more activity because of the unbundling of the applications group from the operating systems.
Jonathan Zittrain.
I'm a little bit skeptical of the remedy. I suppose all of us have no idea what's on the other side of the abyss when you actually start slicing and dicing. It's true that Microsoft has at least overwhelming market share, whether or not contestable, in these applications like word processors. And as Stephen says, they're pretty fundamental things, you know, the manipulation of words on a screen. On the other hand, traditionally at least, these operating systems have been the thread that weaves it all together. And whoever controls the gate of that operating system is the entity that can control what applications will be successful and
but
what
Steve,
won't.
Steve is saying that there's a lot of operating system competition and challenge to Microsoft even now, right? Is that your point, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, if you have to look beyond. I mean, that's not so much, you know, it's nice to have Apple back in the picture finally, but, you know, I don't think there's real competition coming there. But, you know, you look at it as the web as a potential rival, as a platform that things are being built on. I mean, Yahoo is getting into the software business. People, you know, use their calendar applications through Yahoo now. And so, you know, 5 years from now, they well may be, you know, building a platform on top of the web for selling software there. There's the wireless domain. There's the Palm OS for Palm top tablet-like devices. There's Java. There are a bunch of different alternatives out there in a way that there certainly weren't 4 or 5 years ago.
See, I think Steve is absolutely right about that. There are these whole new territories opened up to us of potential growth and innovation and all sorts of interesting little companies getting in and doing interesting things there. They're the ones that are going to put the internet into your refrigerator, and there isn't yet a dominant internet refrigerator OS maker. The question is going to be, is there some advantage that could be used by the dominant meat and potatoes personal computer operating system maker? And there it's Microsoft. You're sending your kid to college. She wants to get a computer to work. It's going to be a Windows machine at this point, even today. Is there some advantage that OS maker has to be able to leverage the monopoly there into other areas? And to me, the story of the browser wars is the story of, in addition to competing hard, using that operating system monopoly to leverage into what previously had been a free-for-all, an open area, who knows who will win.
Okay, if I could ask a question here to the two panelists.
Steve Johnson.
Which I think gets to the heart of this. I mean, one of the little side kind of issues here is that if this goes through as Jackson outlined it, Gates has to put his shares behind one of the two companies. He can't hold stock in both of them. So which company does he back, effectively? Does he bet on the applications group or on the OS group?
There's a wonderful question. Who knows? Are you there, Bill Gates? what do you think, Jonathan?
That's my reading of the thing as well. Certainly the high-level officers can't hold shares in both of the companies, whichever is the parent and whichever is the child. If I'm Gates, I'm going to go with the OS. I'm going to go with that which has been tried and true. It looked like DOS was dead, but we were able to take DOS and reinvent it into Windows. Windows is on the ropes. Clearly, we're going to try to reinvent it into something else. I'll let the boring downstream applications go and try to hold on to my leverage, which is the OS.
What is the Ron Cass? I mean, what are the implications here for this industry's ability to kind of manage itself, to break itself up, to find new balances and competitions here?
Well, clearly the order that Judge Jackson entered yesterday will interfere with a lot of the natural change that might have happened. It's a highly regulatory order. When I first read the news accounts of it, I imagined that this was an order that pretty clearly said, we're going to break the company in two, there are a few limitations we're going to enter here, and go at it. That's not what the order looks like, and I think it will be, if it were to take effect in the form in which it was entered, it would be very difficult for the industry to cope with. All kinds of regulatory restrictions are packed in there right now.
It's clear that Judge Jackson doesn't trust Microsoft, and he basically feels at least once burned by them. Not just, hey, you know, companies are going to push the law to the maximum extent, that's what they're designed to do. But there was an instance in the prior case, the one in which Judge Jackson was ultimately reversed by the Court of Appeals, where he had given them an order that said, look, you've got to give OEMs, that's like Dell and Compaq, the option not to include Internet Explorer along with Windows when they sell their computers that have Windows on them to downstream customers like you and me. At least while the thing is on appeal, that's what you've got to do. Microsoft responded to that order by telling people like Dell and Compaq, okay, since we have to answer the order, here are your choices. You can either do it the way you used to, which is put in Windows and IE together like you always have, or you can use version 1 of Windows 95 from several years ago, which won't work with any of the new software. So it's entirely up to you, and here we are listening to the judge's order. It's clear that Jackson was really, really stung by that and thought, I think rightfully, that Microsoft was being way too clever by half in responding to his order. So a lot of this regulatory stuff we see now, I think, can be directly traced. He used the word disingenuous in his memorandum and order yesterday. I think that's what he had in mind.
Could I ask you all, what is the chance that it was over for Bill Gates anyway, with the rise of the web and Palm Pilots and all these other things that you spoke about, Steve Johnson? What's the chance that the world had already kind of got Bill Gates in its sights?
Well, the irony, I think, about some of this is that precisely the kind of final straw here that triggered a lot of this, which is that, you know, the real integration of the browser into the operating system, was exactly what we were saying somewhat kind of contemptuously, again, 4 or 5 years ago, that Microsoft wouldn't be able to do, that they were, you know, they didn't get the Internet, and they were slow, and the web was moving much faster than them, and they were just, you know, kind of this old dinosaur, the way IBM had become a dinosaur a decade or two before. And it, you know, it turned out they actually managed to move pretty quickly and figure out how to get it right. In fact, Internet Explorer is the best browser out there, I would say, right now. I mean, I use it kind of in spite of myself.
Now, of course, it is ironic that what happened in this case is what happened in the IBM case. Just at the point when the industry is changing, when all these new forces are coming to bear, and the dominant player is facing a whole series of challenges, is when the Justice Department says, no, no, you're too dominant, we've got to break you up.
I want to go to calls. It's 1-800-423-8255 to join the conversation on Microsoft. 1-800-423-TALK. Bob is calling from a car phone.
Hi, folks. I was wondering, what the financial implications, for the breakup are. What would a shareholder of Microsoft own after breakup, and you know, from a structural sort of corporate organizational standpoint, you know, it's not as if they're able to break up a company into having different territories and so forth. If you have two companies that are, you know, an OS company and an applications company, you know, they're obviously working, they're still designing, you know, software for a particular operating system. What are the real tangible differences are going to be, you know, between these two companies once they have different management teams and different ownership? I mean, aren't they really going to be doing the same thing?
Bob, Jonathan Zittrain.
My understanding from reading it is that if you're a shareholder of Microsoft right now and the divestiture actually takes place, according to a plan, by the way, that Microsoft is asked to come up with, they're supposed to create the formula for their own divestiture, something I'll be very intrigued to see if they ever do. You'll end up with two shares where before you had one or something like that, one in the new company and one in the old, and then you'd be free to sell one or the other. So that's how it would work for a run-of-the-mill shareholder. As to the resulting companies, I think you're right that the two companies would be differentiated at first by their starting points. One is holding the keys to Windows, the other to Office, the apps, and the Internet stuff. And from there, they're free in some sense, maybe not to work with each other, but to grow again. There's nothing to stop this new OS company from starting to make applications. There's nothing to stop this applications company from starting to design a new OS.
Hmm. Bob, interesting question. A good answer. 1-800-423-8255. Steve is calling from a car phone.
Hi, Chris.
Welcome, Steve.
And panelists. I'm an engineer, by the way, and I don't really completely understand the legal aspects of the antitrust situation. However, I wanted to ask if there isn't a major definitional problem in the issue about the browser being in the operating system, and whether Microsoft could poke a hole in this by simply saying that that the browser, I mean, as an engineer, I think of a browser as a program that displays files on my screen. They're hypertext files. Originally, there was no active content. And the function of displaying files on a computer is an operating system function, that just as the type command. I know it maybe that's a little bit of a stretch, or the more command in Unix. But basically, you need to be able to see data on the screen. Why can't that be an operating system function, and why can't you simply look at Netscape Communications as a company that built a business based on something that would inevitably become part of an operating system?
Is that your question, Steve Johnson?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very good question, and it gets to something maybe even a little bit bigger than that, which is there are a lot of things that that Microsoft has done, or that the market has done in response to Microsoft's products, that I think contradict a little bit of Jackson's ruling in this, which is that we like integration, we like standards. The drive towards having a common kind of lingua franca that everybody uses, even if it's a proprietary one, is a very powerful thing. And a lot of what Microsoft achieved in getting to that, you know, kind of 90% market share that it has, both in the OS side and in the application side, is because people like to consolidate around one product, and they like to have their browser integrated into the operating system because it does make sense on a certain level. So, you know, the thorniest question here is imagine a kind of alternative Microsoft that managed to get to that same level of kind of dominance in the industry without breaking any laws, with just, you know, convincing the market that it should consolidate around these products. Do we still have a reason for breaking them up?
That is Steve Johnson of Feedmag.com. You're listening to The Connection. Jonathan Zittrain, your turn on the same question.
Yes, Steve the caller, you raise a great question, one that has bedeviled all parties to the case from the very beginning. Scott Warden of Microsoft loves to just raise the question, show me the browser, show me where the browser is. You can't tell me what's browser code and what's OS code. And the Justice Department says that's because you've scrambled them together as thoroughly as possible, precisely to make it a hard question. If you ask purists, they're going to have a hard time, I think, either telling you what's an operating system function and what isn't, or they're going to be purists and say, no, an operating system is exactly this, and that's not the path the Justice Department has wanted to take. Instead, what they've done is they've said, all right, Microsoft, if you take this product and you offer it separately, then we know it's not just part of the core OS. So long as Internet Explorer is offered in a box and you can buy it without having to buy Windows, we ought to be able to buy Windows without buying the Internet Explorer.
Could I ask you all, how much room is there left to argue the sort of fundamental philosophical point? The government says it is kind of clearing the playing field so that all these young tigers can compete effectively. And Bill Gates still says, no, the government is micromanaging. It's writing business plans for a new world and get out of our way. How do we pursue that argument or understand it better?
Well, Chris, if I can jump in on
Ron Cass, please.
I think that the fundamental argument will keep playing out in every subtext that we have here, because whether you're talking about Judge Jackson's ruling on tying or Judge Jackson's ruling on pricing, or you're talking about implementation of the remedy, questions about where we draw the line between middleware and other applications, where we draw the line between the browser and the operating system, what you'll get from both sides again and again is a basic philosophic difference in how they look at this market. I don't think we can get away from that argument.
Steve Johnson?
I think to me the biggest question is really it really gets back to this kind of innovation issue. I mean, I feel like, you know, the other really disingenuous argument that I think Gates has made is that this is going to discourage innovation in the sense that entrepreneurs aren't going to want to be Bill Gates because, you know, they're going to worry that the government is going to come and, you know, kind of break up their companies if they're successful, which seems, you know, absurd. Obviously, even if Gates' stock, you know, decreases by a third because of this, there's still, you know, $30 billion worth of incentive out there to encourage people to become the next Bill Gates.
I think there's
Jonathan Zittrain.
There's no absence of people wanting to be the next Bill Gates. Certainly, by next Bill Gates, I take it to mean not only take what had been a pretty parched area and really enhance it. I mean, create stuff that vaults ahead and, in this case, makes it incredibly available to consumers. Consumers now can have a computer on the desktop and use it in a way that they just couldn't before. It wasn't available to them thanks to Bill Gates. But the other component of being Bill Gates is being the baron, being in control of the barony, drawing the lines that define it, being in complete mastery of everything within those lines, and then once you've got that house in order, pushing the lines out in every direction by whatever means necessary. And the key of antitrust law is to say, not by any means necessary. There are some means that you're entitled to use and other means that you can't, and we've got to stop you from doing it if we want to see to it that we don't just end up with all these new areas, wireless, refrigerators, you name it, themselves becoming controlled baronies where before there had been healthy competition and open standards.
Ron Cass, you want a last word on the antitrust line there before the break?
I do think that Jonathan's right, that antitrust law has a role to play in saying where the boundaries are. The real argument here is going to be whether Judge Jackson has drawn those lines in the right place.
Ron Cass, thank you enormously for joining us. Dean of the Boston University Law School. Steve Johnson, editor of FeedMag.com, thank you for being with us. Jonathan Zittrain, thank you for standing by. We're talking about Judge Penfield Jackson's cut the baby in half decision in the Microsoft case. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. Wow. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Microsoft Connection, 1-800-423-8255. We're imagining a world with two Microsofts or half Microsofts in it, according to Judge Jackson's decision. Philip Greenspun joins us. His company is Ars Digita. He teaches at MIT. He teaches his own web boot camps for all comers. Phil Greenspun, I'm particularly interested in what's been happening out there in the world with Microsoft distracted, its eye off the ball for 2.5 years. What is happening in the rest of software world, web world, that you see?
Well, Microsoft, I think, has been distracted even more than by the lawsuit by the fact that they have a campus. You know, they're in a very isolated location talking to each other. Companies that do that don't get the benefits of companies in Silicon Valley or in cities where their employees, you know, walk out on the street, talk to people from other firms, and, you know, get new ideas. So I think that the reason why Microsoft has had so little impact on the internet is that their people aren't connected to anyone outside the company, to anybody innovating. So that's kind of gotten them stuck in the desktop world. So I think the big trend that has been going on while they've been fighting the Justice Department and working on Windows 2000 and Office 2000 is that if you look at a graph starting in the 1970s with Xerox, they invented the desktop app, and then the hardware engineers in the 80s made computers so cheap that everybody had a desktop app. You know, by 1995, people were lining up at midnight to buy a new operating system, to buy Windows 95. But already people were starting to shift to web-based applications. So, you know, people would use Yahoo Calendar instead of a desktop program to manage their calendar, or Hotmail. I mean, that's the one area where Microsoft is actually a big factor because they acquired this company, Hotmail. So the shift to web-based applications already happened, actually, probably by 97 when the case started. But I think that now the really interesting trend is if you look at most websites, you're interested in about 3 or 4 lines of information, and they give you a banner ad on top, navigation on top, navigation down the side, little teasers on the right-hand side of the page. Right. Somewhere buried in there is the information you want, and they say, hey, you know, you probably have a 21-inch monitor, 100-key keyboard, and a huge mousing service, and you can navigate to the stuff you care about. If you're browsing from a cell phone with a 3-line display, there's a real technology and programming challenge of delivering people the right 3 lines. So I think that that's something where Microsoft hasn't done any work on what people need for enterprise applications. So that's been kind of a shame because they do have a lot of good programmers. And I also think the breakup is kind of a shame, frankly, because it won't give people what they want. And I think in 1995 it would have been interesting to have a standalone operating system company. At this point, people don't care what operating system their cell phone is running. They're not going to line up at midnight to buy a new one, and they're going to want systems that upgrade themselves. The real interesting thing about Microsoft is probably Office, and as long as that's one company, nobody will ever be able to build a competitive spreadsheet, because the spreadsheet, the word processor, the browser, all this, the database like Microsoft Access, they all talk to each other by kind of private interfaces. They don't really document all the interfaces. So I think if Microsoft were broken up into 6 companies, you'd see some real competition.
This is fascinating, but I can't digest it that as fast as you can say it. What does this changing, this sort of moving focus to the point where now, you know, the interest is in the 3-line display, what is that, how, and sort of well past the Microsoft era of of Windows world, what does that tell you about the necessity or the burden, the impact, the importance of this decision? I mean, how did, if you just had, you know, 10 minutes with Judge Jackson's ear or the Supreme Court's ear, what would you be telling them about the meaning of this breakup?
What I just said, although maybe I should have said it slower, I would have said that basically what the world needs is, what it's applications that users sit at. They don't really care about the operating system plumbing underneath.
Right.
And you need a way for, you need an environment in which new applications can flower. Now, the fact that Microsoft does have a desktop right. monopoly isn't as bad as it once was, because the applications that people are demanding are web-based applications. So there's a couple things. I guess one is, you know, the phone company was prevented from using its monopoly profits in telephone service from buying all the small innovative companies that were using the transistor. They invented the transistor, but they couldn't actually, you know, they couldn't own every radio company. They don't, AT&T never owned Sony. And Microsoft, by being, you know, it's been an unregulated monopoly, and it's been able to use its profits to buy a lot of the innovators, which has been destructive, I think. You know, buying things like Hotmail and Web TV probably made it harder for other, the acquisition by Microsoft of Web TV has probably made it harder for other little appliance companies to get off the ground. So there's two things. They probably shouldn't be able to buy some of these innovative web-based companies in order to preserve competition there, which is where the real action is. Mm. And that if they were broken up into a separate word processor and spreadsheet company, say, then those programs would have to communicate by a publicly advertised interface. And that would open up the possibility for all kinds of clever people to read the interface and say, hey, I can actually slot my little program in here.
Right.
And have it tie closely to the spreadsheet or closely to the word processor.
But if a Supreme Court judge said, Phil Greenspan, help me out here, has the world moved past the Microsoft emergency, can we sort of relax about this case, what would you say?
I would say that we could relax about this case if we would take a leaf from Mahatma Gandhi's book, that, you know, Mahatma Gandhi would not have sat at Microsoft Word writing a legal brief to the government about how bad Microsoft was. You know, he believed in Swaraj and self-reliance. So basically,
I must say, this is a legal doctrine with which I'm somewhat unfamiliar.
Well, the government 3 years ago should have said, we're going to make a commitment to... The problem with Linux is the poverty of the commons, the tragedy of the commons. Basically, you know, our little company, we only have 120 programmers, so it isn't worth our while to invest heavily in making Linux better than Windows, say, or improving Linux, because we only have 120 programmers who can benefit from that change, and another, you know, 30 or 5 odd admin and management people. Whereas the government, they have millions of employees. So basically, if the government had said, you know, we don't want to pay a tax to Microsoft anymore each time we hire somebody, so we're going to invest enough money in Linux and open source applications so that we can run the government on all this free software and not suffer in any way, that would have then created enough of a community of this stuff to let all the smaller industrial firms use that. So I think the most interesting thing the government could have done with Microsoft is not to sue them, but to break free of them themselves. So that is Mahatma Gandhi's concept of Swaraj. That's complaining about the, you know, British tax on salt. Go to the sea and make your own salt.
Don't go away, Phil Greenspan. We're talking about the Microsoft case and Judge Jackson's decision. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. The Harvard internet guru Jonathan Zittrain is with us in the studio. Arana is on the line.
Welcome. A little nervous going to be on the phone, but a comment that someone made earlier about the browser not being that much of a big deal and it's just part of the operating system, I kind of wanted to bring in what Microsoft is doing to try to corner the market on the web and control the web. They are in the process with their next release of Internet Explorer of distorting the World Wide Web Consortium standard so that it appears to not work while their proprietary technology does work. And as far as, and the standard is around using dynamic content, which is the hot new thing on the web. And they've gone and implemented 80% of the standard in Internet Explorer 5.5 so that when you use it, it doesn't really work right. So, but if you use ActiveX, which is theirs, it works just great.
Hmm.
But it's proprietary, and they own it. And they get to decide how it's going to be developed, and therefore how the web gets developed.
Is this kind of complaint about Microsoft fair? Is it on the money, Jonathan Zittrain?
I think it's a pretty tried and true strategy, and I would guess...
Which, Microsoft's or...
Of Microsoft's.
Or the complaint?
No,
okay.
Of Microsoft's, and I think Bill Gates might answer it by saying, yep, it's a free country, and, you know, we call it embrace and extend. We take a standard that had been out there for anybody to use and take, and we improve it, and sure enough, in improving it, we make it incompatible with certain other things that use that open standard. But hey, take it or leave it. And when you're having the market share that Microsoft has, to say take it or leave it to the community may mean the community grits its teeth and together has to take it rather than leave it. So I agree that this is a strategy for which I don't know how much the current remedy does what it's supposed to do. So it's something to keep an eye out for. The other issue maybe worth raising is I found in what Phil had said earlier, it connects up with a whole bunch of new baronies that might be something that Microsoft or a Microsoft-like company could take advantage of. For instance, Phil mentioned phones, and you look at those four lines on your Nokia phone. Right now, as I understand it, there's one company that basically does the phone browser. So that could potentially be, if that becomes a new gateway to the Internet and to commerce, that one company could be in a position to impose its little tax. Time Warner or other cable companies, which are giving high-speed Internet access to the home, are in a position perhaps to favor some content, perhaps Time Warner content, over others. It's obviously, you know, it's all speculative, but this does seem to have two phases. The first is too early to tell. The second is too late to do anything about it. And acting when it's too early to tell always has its dangers. Of course, it's hard to act when it's too late to do anything about it.
Phil Greenspan, are you there?
I am here.
Did you want to comment on Arana's point?
Well, you know, I think the phone market, fewer than 1% of the people who are going to be browsing the Internet via phone are doing so. So, you know, I don't want to get depressed in advance about the...
It's too early to tell, right?
...the coming monopoly in the phone world. I'm interested, people have been talking since the late 60s, since the network was new, about all your home appliances being hooked up to the net. And the, I'm interested in seeing what happens when companies start putting in network interfaces on, say, sofas for customer support. If I order a sofa from furniture.com and it arrives at my house and I call them up and say I want to return it because, you know, the springs are too saggy, I want them to be able to say, hey, Mr. Greenspan, we telnetted to your sofa and the load sensors tell us that, you know, you weigh 300 pounds and you need the lard-ass spring options, which we're going to FedEx to you. It's a field upgradable install, so you don't have to send your sofa back. You know, I think that when all these things are networked, that you'll have an explosion of creativity that we haven't seen right now, where we still have the computers basically, they've come out of the glass rooms onto people's desks, but they're still not pervasive in people's lives. I actually have to go. Believe it or not, I have Yo-Yo Ma here, so I don't want to keep him waiting.
We don't want to do it either. We want to enlist in your boot camp, though, Phil Greenspan, and we'd like you to send us instructions, send us the route to get to the Ars Digita boot camp. Phil Greenspan, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Connection. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Microsoft decision connection. 1-800-423-8255 with Jonathan Zittrain of the Berkman Center on Internet and Society at the Harvard Law School. 1-800-423-8255. Ali is calling from a car phone.
Yes, hi. Good morning, Chris.
Morning, Ali.
I have a question for you guys. Does the law prohibit the new companies from merging again in a few years from now, for example?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Growing back together, so to speak?
Yeah.
Yes, it does. I think those are some of the conduct remedies, or it's part of the class of them that the dean of the BU law school was not very happy with. And it does prohibit, I think, at least for 4, maybe up to 10 years, the companies from having all sorts of relationships, certainly including growing back together again.
So after 10 years, can we have another Microsoft?
It's quite possible. And I guess people are thinking 10 years from now, who knows what the landscape may look like.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Ali. 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about Judge Jackson's decision in the Microsoft case. Tom is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Tom.
I'm a software engineer in Cambridge. I wanted to talk about operating system integration. And I think an important thing to realize is that an operating system's role is to provide resources to the applications. So a proper way to integrate an operating system in a browser would be to give resources, put resources into the operating system that browser developers could use. That's the right way under software engineering to merge the functionality. Whereas what Microsoft did is put an actual application into the operating system, or they claim to have done that. And I think it's an important distinction to make.
Tom, it sounds like you would have made a good expert witness at the trial. I think the reason the government basically didn't call somebody like you or you for this was because they didn't want to get into a battle of orthodoxies with Microsoft, because then they would be open to the charge, perhaps rightfully, where Microsoft would say, who is the government to tell us what the right way to build an OS or integrate things into the OS is? And that's why they took this more functionalist approach, saying, if you put it in a box and you put a label on it and sell it as a separate product, then we know it's not truly part of the operating system and shouldn't be necessarily bolted to it.
Well, that may be good marketing, but it's very bad engineering.
Yes, yes. No, I've heard that from a number of people.
Tom, thank you.
Thank you.
1-800-423-8255. Eric is calling from a car phone.
Hello.
Welcome, Eric.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'd like to make a comment about innovation after the breakup. I do agree with some of what Philip Greenspun said, that the innovation will not be immediate in all areas. But I think it's important to recognize that the Microsoft Office suite is the de facto standard for business application. And if you're going to communicate with other people in business, you need to have that application suite, which pretty much at this point ties you to the Microsoft OS. I think after the breakup, one of the things that we're going to see is that there's going to be a business motivation for the application suite to be ported to other operating systems like macOS and Linux. And I think that's going to start some innovation. And I'd like to get some comments on that.
Jonathan Zittrain.
I think that's certainly the idea behind the breakup, that if you put the apps people out on their own, they're going to start thinking about other platforms equally, instead of just going back to the mothership and making everything geared towards Windows and part of a master strategic plan to keep Windows dominant. It'll actually be, okay, how can we get these applications populated wherever you may go, your telephone, your Mac computer, your Linux computer, etc. So I do think there's something to that. Of course, at some point, too, once you get past version 4 or 5 of a given application, it starts to get a little crusty. It's unclear what you get out of Word 8.0 or 9.0 or 10.0 that you didn't have in 6.0, and you start competing with yourself. And unless you can strategically start yanking things off the market and then upgrading the OS such that the old software doesn't work so well with the OS, you really do have to start innovating. And maybe the new innovations will take place around either networking all this stuff together or doing so-called groupware. But the other thing to look for is to see software become itself a service rather than a product. Instead of going to the store and getting a CD-ROM or even going online and downloading your Word, you'll simply go to some particular company mothership, which also has your data in safe storage in case your house gets hit by lightning, and go on and use a word processor that's generated on your screen from that company in real time. And you won't have to worry about versions of this or that.
Eric, I hope that does it. Jonathan, I have a general civilian question for you. It seems to me, I mean, this whole world has been governed by the famous Moore's Law, that chip speed doubles every 18 months, productivity ever upward, prices ever downward. It seems to me the other law, and maybe this is Phil Greenspun's contribution here, is that the explosive changes in this marketplace change faster than any government remedy can work itself out, given all the paperwork, the deliberation, the trials, the reconsideration, the appeals, etc. In other words, that the government case against Microsoft, which may have been at a sort of 1995 problem, filed in 97, decided in the year 2000, is already obsolete, that in some strange way, the legal case almost doesn't matter. Is this possible?
Yes, I remember seeing an argument between Rick Rule, who used to work for the Reagan Justice Department and of late has worked for Microsoft, and Gary Reback, the well-known Microsoft nemesis, who among others represents Netscape. I think it was in 1993 or 1992 even, on the topic of, is Microsoft going to swallow the net? And even then, the argument was made precisely because the law can't keep up with this. It had better keep its hands off. This thing is just moving too quickly, and the law had better clear out of the way. Maybe it could ideally make a tweak here or there, but it just isn't going to happen. I think it is a really hard problem. This is moving quickly, and you know, you worry that you're fixing 1995 problems
today. Well, it's funny because the law, even if it doesn't catch up, it has an effect. But it's only one of many effects that are going on in this world.
Yes. My own thought on this has been captured by the phrase, law might be able to prevent the problem that it can't patch. Instead of waiting for the problem to arise and then chasing it like a dog going after the newspaper delivery truck, there may be some structural things government can do to keep more open markets. And in my thinking, that has meant looking towards intellectual property. The basis of the Microsoft monopoly is a monopoly called copyright. And that is a subsidy, an incentive given by the government to anybody that can present a piece of software under current law. And they get that software protected from competition in the sense of it can't be copied and people can't use the source code to make new software derivative to it for 95 years. After 95 years, it enters into the public domain and anybody can do what they want with it. So I'm imagining these people salivating in 2085 when the TRS-80 Radio Shack computer source code finally opens up. It seems 95 is a little too long. If government were to pull that limit back, maybe that would be a way of preventing future monopolies.
It seems fair to say that whether or not this case is affirmed, reversed, or just plain forgotten, the world is never going to go back to the way it was when this case was brought before Microsoft was challenged.
These are definitely interesting times, and this is a landmark decision.
Jonathan Zittrain, always a pleasure. Jonathan Zittrain is the executive director of the Berkman Center at the Harvard Law School. Thanks also to Phil Greenspun of Ars Digita and MIT. Thanks also to Steve Johnson and Ronald Cass, who joined us earlier in the hour. Listeners, you can continue the conversation about the Microsoft case on our website at theconnection.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.